Ron Julian presented his intellectual autobiography as the fourth talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on January 30th, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Probably you're all familiar now with what the premise of this series is. Jack has asked several of us to talk about our intellectual journey to the faith, how we came to believe what we believe about the Christian faith. I'm sure you recognize the temptation. I mean, to be asked to spend the entire evening talking about yourself. Oh rats, I have to talk about myself. So I hope I don't succumb to that temptation too much, but it's hard not to. As Jack has said in introducing this series, this is not exactly a testimony, and it's not exactly intended to be an apologetic either. I'm not going to lay out a systematic case for my views. There are elements of both testimony and apologetic, though, in what I have to say. I want to look at two questions tonight. How did I come to my beliefs about Christianity? And how did I come to my beliefs about belief? I'm going to tell you what I mean there. My own struggles from the beginning have always centered around these two issues. First of all, the fundamental questions of the faith. What is the Christian faith? What does it mean to be a Christian? What has God promised? What am I supposed to do? All of those sorts of questions. But there's also that question up above it, which is, how do you figure this stuff out? How do you know the answers to those questions? Can you know the answers to those questions? Can the Bible be understood? How should I read it? And is it possible to know the truth of these things at all? Those are the two kinds of issues that have driven me from the beginning. So those are the things I'll talk about tonight. And I do seriously want to warn you that when you put together a talk like this, I've never actually done this before, this is sort of interesting, but when you put together a talk like this, it all ends up sounding very neat. I mean, you would think, what a perceptive guy. I mean, this sort of, you know, straight arrow shot to the truth through his life, and this is just not it at all. I mean, this was an incredibly painful and messy sort of flailing around sort of process. Those of you who have known me a long time can testify to the fact that that's the way it was. So that's not, you know, this is going to all sound very clean, but it was not clean. I grew up in a non-Christian home, but from the age of when I was born to when I was like 10 years old, I believed in God the way you believe in Santa Claus. I mean, I just thought everybody believes in God. I heard God talked about. I assume people knew what they were talking about, so there must be a God. At the age of 10, something very significant happened to me. This was at the time when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And in my family, my mother was a huge devotee of JFK. She loved him. And so she came to talk to me after his death, and as I think back on it now, I mean, it was quite significant that she would go out of her way to do this. But what she did is she came to me and she said, I don't know whether you believe in God or not, but if there is a heaven, I'm sure that Kennedy has gone there. I mean, now she wasn't really a believer or anything, but she was just, I don't know exactly why she sought me out to say this, but clearly, I mean, she was very upset herself about what had happened. So, I mean, it was a very significant thing in our personal relationship that she would come and talk to me about a thing like this, but it had a very different effect on me than she was anticipating, I think. Because I thought, as soon as she said it, I thought, you don't know whether I believe in God or not, You mean I have a choice? And I mean, she was talking about JFK and this sad thing. And I was thinking, I don't have to believe in God. You can decide whether you believe in God. And so right there, before she left the room, right there, I decided, I do not believe in God. It was a firm decision. As soon as she acknowledged that there might be an option, I said, I'm out. I'm not believing in that. And from the age of 10 to the age of 18, I was a full-fledged, proud, and dedicated atheist. I mean, I was committed to it. I looked down on those who were not atheists. That period of my life, I'd characterize my atheism. I'm sure there are all kinds of things we could talk about. Three things that strike me as I think about it now. Number one, I was in despair, but I was very proud of that fact. I loved my despair. I saw life as dark and meaningless, ending in nothingness, and I thought I was incredibly brave and noble for looking into the abyss and seeing it the way it was. Number two, I was uneasy about the problem of morality. I believed in right and wrong. Although I had a dark view of life, I had not abandoned the idea that there were rights and wrongs. I believed in them, but I had no basis for talking about that stuff. I read The Brothers Karamazov, which has the famous theme, if there is no God, then everything is permitted. And I got so mad when I read that in the book that I took the book and I threw it across the room. That can't be right. There must be something wrong with that. That can't possibly be right. But I didn't have an answer to it, so I was ticked off. And then probably the third and most important feature of my atheism, I believed that Christians were gullible, and I was not. I was a reasonable person. I was a person who believed in evidence and rationality. And especially, you know, you needed empirical evidence in order to believe something like this. I used to say to myself, well, sure, if I had seen the parting of the Red Sea, then I would believe in God too. I had a teacher who made us read Francis Schaeffer in high school, which is not something that would happen these days. But he did. He was a Christian, and he, in a philosophy class, he had us read Francis Schaeffer's Escape from Reason. And Schaeffer as I think back on it now, he hit those three points that were an aspect of my atheism. In terms of despair, he said, well, maybe my despair was a fault of my worldview. Maybe it wasn't something to be proud of, but maybe it indicated there was something wrong with the way I was looking at things. He said that God was indeed necessary for good and evil to make sense, and he argued that Christianity was intellectually coherent and actually the intellectually superior alternative. And I hated him. I really did. I hated that book. I looked on it with a great deal of contempt. And I should say, by the way, that right after I became a Christian, Schaeffer was my first big positive influence. Like a lot of people who became Christians in the 1970s, Francis Schaeffer was my mentor for a while. I mean, he really contributed some incredibly valuable things to me in those early days. But when I first encountered him, when I wasn't a Christian, I thought he was full of it. Okay, my conversion happened. I was saved by a group of bored high school students performing a cheesy evangelistic musical. At least this is what everybody told me afterwards, is that they would say, that was awful. It was so embarrassing. I was so embarrassed that this came to our church. It was so tacky. But I was sitting there watching it, and I was sweating. This thought had crossed my mind while I was listening to these fake testimonials. It occurred to me, what if this is true? And my heart was pounding, and I was like petrified that I was going to end up believing this stuff. And I was really upset. And then that evening, three different people came up to me and testified to me and tried to convince me to become a Christian. Well, I didn't give in right away, but this experience inspired me to go to every Christian that I knew and try to convince them that Christianity was a crock. I'm going to work this out by going and showing them what the problem is with this Christianity stuff so that I don't have to think about it anymore. But in the process of doing that, I learned a couple of things. In a funny sort of way, I would go and raise this objection, and sometimes they wouldn't have an answer exactly to give, but in the process of talking with them, I started to see that there was something actually compelling about what they were thinking that I had not acknowledged before. So I started to see that there was a lot more to this Christianity stuff than I had given it credit for before. But most importantly, this process of wrestling that happened for a couple of weeks before I finally actually gave in and became a Christian, I learned something about myself, and it is one of my fundamental beliefs about humanity, about our relationship with God, how we know things, and I came to encounter it in this process of my conversion. And that fundamental truth is, that I believe in, is that what we know and believe is very much a matter of the will. What I mean by that is that we are not objective observers of reality. We conform our beliefs to be in keeping with what we want to be true. And I discovered this about myself in this process. I would actually describe it to myself. I was like an observer watching what I was doing as I was doing all of this. And I described it to myself as I kind of come tiptoeing up to the edge, I look over, and then I run screaming in the other direction. And I kept doing this over and over again. I look, and then I'd run. But the thing about it is that I started to get unnerved by this process because I had always described that it was the Christians who were the ones who were sort of being driven by their emotions and all this stuff. I was the reasonable one. If the evidence is taking you a certain direction, then that's where you go. And the Christians are the ones who were just irrational, and they just believed what they wanted to believe. But what I was seeing about myself is that even though the option of Christianity was starting to look more and more like a reasonable way to go, I wouldn't go there. It didn't matter whether it was reasonable or not. I didn't want to go. And it sounds like it was so clear to me. But it was, to a certain extent, clear even then. I mean, I noticed, I found myself saying to people things like, I don't really have room for God in my life. I have plans, and I don't want God coming along and tell me what to do. And then I'd go away and think about it and think, that's kind of weird. What if there was a God? I mean, would that be a rational approach to take? Well, there is a God, but I think I don't want to have anything to do with him. But I was shocked by myself in this process. I was experiencing this growing tension between the reasonableness of Christianity and my hostility toward it. And I had to come to terms with that. So when I did become a Christian, and by the way, I can't really tell you exactly how this process happened. How did I cross the line? I didn't want to, I didn't want to, I didn't want to, and then I did want to. And I don't know what it is. Well, I think I do know what it is, but I couldn't tell you what the process was going on inside of me. I resisted and I resisted, and then I stopped resisting. But after I became a Christian, what I learned about myself, I saw being confirmed, I think, in various things that I saw. I saw things in the Bible. I read the story of the parting of the Red Sea, the Exodus, and all of that stuff. And now remember, I had been thinking, well, if I had seen that stuff, then I would have empirical evidence, and then I would believe. But if you read the story, this is the story written by the Jews about themselves, that they see God part the Red Sea, but they still don't trust him. And in the end, they say, let's kill Moses and go back to Egypt. So, I mean, I looked at it and I said, well, why did, obviously just having empirical evidence is not necessarily all it takes here. There's something else involved. I read the very famous passage in Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, and so on. Well, I looked at that, and given what I had gone through, this made sense to me, that there is a knowledge of God available. We could know him, but we don't want to. The evidence comes in, our mental processes take on the things having to do with God, but there's something in us that doesn't want to deal with it, and so we distort it and end up turning it into something that it's not. And that made a lot of sense to me. And Romans is describing this as a fundamental moral flaw. This is our problem as human beings, that we will not know the truth straight, especially about God. That if truths come in that we don't want to deal with, we find a way of messing with them so that we don't have to confront it. So that seemed to me to be a very biblical idea, and it was certainly very true of my experience. Okay, so I became a Christian. I had little knowledge of Christian doctrine at this point. Basically, I surrendered to God. Basically, what I said is, I am willing to know you if you are there to be known. But I knew nothing. I mean, I discovered, like a couple weeks after I became a Christian, somebody gave me the book, many of you have heard me say this before, but The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey. And I read that book because they gave it to me, and I realized, oh yeah, I forgot. Christians believe in life after death. I had forgotten that was a part of the deal. I mean, that wasn't what was on my mind. The question was, is there a God that I have to deal with or not? And I've been saying, no, 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 no. And then it was, okay, all right, maybe so. And so now I started to discover, well, what is this stuff? I mean, who is this God, and what does the Bible say, and all of that? Okay, so the result of that, one of the main points I would make, that in my journey towards sorting this stuff out, it is my firm belief to this day that the fundamental for each issue, for each one of us, is not how much truth we know, but whether we are willing to know the truth. It is that decision to be willing to know what there is to be known that is the fundamental choice that we have to make. Okay, now, next stage, the painful, very, very painful period of my life. I had two related intellectual struggles as a young Christian that I found very difficult to deal with. These two struggles were such that they were pushing me to call into question even ultimately the truth of the Christianity that I had embraced, which is why I'm talking about it here, because the issue is, how did I come to decide that this stuff is true? The first step was to be willing to see that it was true, but now I was starting to look at the stuff and I was having problems, real problems. My first struggle was theological. I struggled with the nature of salvation, the nature of the gospel itself. I am not in any way comparing myself, but I had a very Martin Luther kind of experience. I very quickly came to understand myself in a deep way to be a sinner. I mean, I don't say that in a trite way. I saw that I was a morally flawed human being, and it went real deep. And the deeper I dug, the worse it got. And what do you do with that? I found it very difficult to believe that God had accepted me. I very much identify with that part of Luther's testimony, you know, that he was afraid of God, and that's kind of how I felt myself. The Christians that I hung out with believed in what we were calling the victorious Christian life. The idea being that there was a power available to free oneself from sin, if you would avail yourself of it, if you would walk by the Spirit, and if you would believe enough and put yourself in a certain frame of mind where, maybe you've heard the phrase, let go and let God. The idea is, if I try to do it, it's going to fail and I will sin, but if I step back and just let the Spirit do it through me, then I will have success and I will not sin. Well, I tried to live this way, because this is what they said, how it worked. And it didn't work for me. This was not getting me anywhere. So at one point I went to my Bible study leader and told him of my struggles. And his response was, look, this stuff works. The Bible says this stuff works. So if it's not working for you, you must not be a believer at all. That's why it's not working. Well, I mean, I just loved to hear that. And it forced me to really have to confront this question. What in the world is going on with this stuff? So I had this terrible doubt whether God had actually saved me at all. And this fueled a kind of a growing doubt whether the Christian gospel was actually livable. I mean, is this stuff... I wasn't saying there is no God, but I was seriously wondering whether this stuff actually made enough sense that you could live it out. I didn't know what to do with it. My second struggle was with the Bible itself. Because of that first struggle over the nature of salvation, I had a great hunger to understand what the Bible was about. You know, if the Bible is spelling out this coherent, compelling way of life, I want to understand and know what that is. But the problem was that everybody had a different idea of what it was that the Bible was saying. Everyone I would talk about this walking by the Spirit, and everybody had a different idea of how that worked. And this group said these guys were wrong, and this group said these guys were wrong. And I remembered the phrase that people said that, oh, you can make the Bible say anything. And I was starting to feel like that was it. You could make the Bible say anything. I started to wonder whether anyone could seriously, really understand what it is that the Bible was saying. And then I looked in the Bible and I came across this. Paul in Romans says we are justified by faith and not by works. This is greatly related to my struggle over the nature of the gospel, right? Can a sinner like me be accepted by God? Paul says, justified by faith and not by works. Great. Paul's my hero. I love Paul. Okay, but James said, we are not justified by faith alone, we're justified by works. Okay, boo James, I hated James. So that's a theological problem, but it's not only a theological problem, it's a confidence in the Bible problem. Because why aren't Paul and James agreeing on what seems to me to be one of the most important questions that we could encounter, right? I mean, who's justified? Who is accepted by God? How could there be a more important question than that? And they don't agree. So I found myself wondering whether the Bible really had it together, at least in a way that I could count on. And I became for a while a kind of a Christian skeptic. I did not want to abandon the faith. I never walked away and said, I am not a Christian anymore. But I became kind of cynical and skeptical that we could ever really know anything about this stuff. Really, it was kind of like a Christianized version of my former atheist self. I was kind of proud of the fact that I didn't have this naive confidence in the Bible that these naive Christians that I knew had. I had seen through it. I knew that this is a lot more complicated than that. You guys don't even know. Have you ever read James? You know? and honestly, I mean, that was... I can remember saying things just like that. It's really embarrassing. I had not lost my willingness to follow God, but I was starting to despair that this was ever going to get me anywhere, really. So I struggled for several years with these things. What was the gospel? Was it actually coherent and livable? Is it possible to understand the Bible? And those questions kept me in a sort of painful state of uncertainty, whether this stuff was true. I wasn't prepared to say it's not true, but I really didn't have any strong reasons for saying it was either. I didn't know what to make of it. I was not going to tell this story because this is not supposed to be a testimony kind of deal. But I've gotten to this spot, and I've decided I want to tell this story because this is a really important story in my life. So I'm just going to tell you this little story. I'll make it real quick. But describing this struggle that I was dealing with, right? There came a day when I decided I have got to just get away and think about this stuff some. And so I went to a friend's house who lived in Santa Cruz. So I spent the day kind of walking on the beach alone the whole day, just kind of thinking about what is going on and you know, where am I going with all of this stuff. And at the end of the day, I sat down with a piece of paper and I basically said to God, God, I am crying out to you. This is the cry of my heart. I am begging you to tell me, to answer these questions. And I wrote on the piece of paper three questions. Question number one is, what is the Bible? How are you supposed to understand this thing? And then question number two was, then kind of a so what? Okay, if after you figure out what the Bible's saying, what does that mean? What is the gospel? How do you live? What is this stuff supposed to be about? And then my third question was, and then what should I do? And I meant by that kind of, I was struggling at the same time as well with, you know, what should I pursue in my life? What should I work at? What should I make my preoccupation in life? So this was this huge cry out to God. And then I went away, as life takes you and you go along and you forget about stuff. And but the striking thing about this story, the thing that means so much to me, is that several years later, I was rummaging around in my stuff and I came across this piece of paper with the three questions that I had asked. And I realized that in the years since I had written it, that God had answered all three of the questions. That I basically felt like I had a good answer to the three questions that I had asked him, that I had cried out, God, answer these questions. Well, if you'd asked me the day after, I would have said he didn't hear me because I'm just as confused as I was before. But I just had this opportunity to say, huh, years later, in fact, God had done what I had asked him to do. So, I mean, I like that story. Okay, so, now, how did that happen? What is the process by which those things came along? There's a lot that I could talk about. I want to pick a couple of key experiences for me that have always struck me as being very important in the decision-making process that I made along the line. First of all, the first one, this happened at a Bible study. Some of you have heard this story before. Some of you have heard all these stories before. I was at a Bible study in 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians was very important to my church because chapter 3 of 2 Corinthians had this language, not that we are adequate in ourselves, but our adequacy is from God. This is the language that's used there. And in my church, the people that I hung around with taught that this was a teaching about the victorious Christian life. That if I try to do it myself, I am not adequate. But if I surrender to the power of God, then I will be adequate and then I will not sin and find the power and all of that. So the pastor at the church that I was involved with at that time, he often said that that passage was like the most important passage in the Bible to him. That if you understood anything, you really needed to understand that. Okay, so I was in this Bible study, and I was, while they were talking about this, I was looking at the passage and kind of trying to read it in context and figure out what was going on. This is not something that I did very much, but I was trying, you know, to sort of wrestle with this. And I noticed, I made my first independent interpretive observation about the Bible. I noticed that in the context just before, that when Paul said we, he meant himself. He said, are we beginning to commend ourselves again, he says. And then he says, do we need letters of recommendation from you or to you? Well, obviously he's talking about himself. Do I need a letter of recommendation from you Corinthians? So I was just sitting there thinking. He said, well, you know, so the we there is not we Christians, because he's distinguished between there's we, me, and you. But so the we are the adequacy that he's talking about seems to be in the context that Paul's saying that his adequacy is from God. And when I looked at the whole discussion, it seemed to me that what he was talking about was his adequacy to be an apostle. The question was, the Corinthians were questioning whether he was an apostle at all. And what he was claiming is that his adequacy was from God. God had prepared him for this task, to be the apostle that he was. Okay, now, I actually think that's right. And if any of you are happen to be at Reformation Fellowship the next couple of weeks, that's what I'm teaching on, and actually we'll talk about that. But whether I was right or not, the thing was that I made this observation. It seemed to me, in context, that seems to be reasonable. I got all excited, raised my hand. I said, hey, everybody, look at this. this totally bombed, because it was messing with, everybody liked this so much. I mean, God's going to, make us adequate and save us from sin and everything. And nobody wanted to hear that Paul was talking about something else than what it was that they had said. And the leader of the Bible study kind of rebuked me a little bit and said, and I remember very clearly, she said, the Bible is God's love letter to me. And if that's talking about Paul and not me as a Christian, then it's not relevant to me. Therefore, that's not what it means. I mean, it was the conclusion that that's not what it means. And so I was flabbergasted by this, and I found myself realizing that I was kind of at a fork in the road. It had not been as clear to me as it was before, that there was kind of this decision that you faced there. I could go down her road, which was kind of, I'm looking for that which I find most personally relevant, and I'll let it mean that. Or I could ask, what is it that Paul was trying to say? And let the chips fall where they may as to how it might end up being personally relevant to me. And I sort of made this decision there that it seemed to me that the right thing to do was to try to understand what Paul or whoever was actually getting at. And I recognized that in a way I was starting down a road that was different than most of the people that were with me there in the room. That's not a road that they wanted to go down. But so that was a very important experience for me. Okay, the second important experience, I've talked about this before. This is the big one, probably. At the church that I went to, which taught this victorious Christian life stuff, there was a young pastor teaching on the Book of Romans. His name was Jack Crabtree. And he was saying stuff that didn't exactly sound like it fit exactly with the theology of what was being taught at this place. And he was starting to notice that himself, I think, actually, at the time. But I was blown away by this teaching from Romans that I was hearing. And because it was speaking directly to my two big struggles that I dealt with. Number one, the theology of the grace of God and the sovereignty of God and all that stuff that was being described from Romans made a lot of sense and spoke to my struggle to try to understand what does it mean to be a Christian in a way that very little that I had heard up to that point did. This just made so much sense and actually was a picture of the faith that I could see why it would be called good news if it was as Jack was describing it. But even more importantly, he was defending his perspective by arguing from the text, see, isn't this what Paul is saying? By appealing to the context and the flow of thought and all of these things that were kind of, I understood about them, but I was not in the habit of doing this sort of thing with the Bible, really, because nobody I knew was in the habit of doing this. I went up to Jack afterwards and said, how did you do that? And he said, well, I have this class on biblical interpretation that I teach. If you want to, that's where I answer that question. How do I do that? So I took that class, and it changed my life. You don't have many opportunities in life to say, I did this, and it changed my life. You can watch the commercials about how I started eating Jenny Craig and changed my life and, all that kind of stuff. But this is an absolutely honest to goodness, it changed my life story. To me, what Jack said about the Bible at this time, it was like, I picture it as like the story of the emperor's new clothes. You remember the story of the emperor's new clothes? the tailors are pretending that they're weaving cloth, but in fact, the emperor's not wearing anything. And everybody's going, oh yeah, what a nice suit you have on, emperor. Except then finally this little boy stands up and says, he's not wearing anything. And everybody goes, oh yeah, he's not wearing anything. And the guy runs away embarrassed. Well, Jack was the little boy that stood up and said, he's not wearing anything for me. Is that I actually was a reasonably skilled reader. I read a lot of literature. This was what I was interested in. My idea was fun was to try to figure out what an author means in an essay or a poem or something like that. I mean, that was the kind of stuff I did. But I never approached the Bible that way because everybody said that's not what you're supposed to do. I mean, you're supposed to, like, go looking for God's message to you and all of this stuff. And I had just never really tried to approach the Bible the way I read anything else in the world. And basically what Jack said is, you know what you do when you read the Bible? You read it. You know, like when you read. You know, like when you start and you say, okay, gee, what are we talking about? And you come to a spot and you say, well, I have to understand this statement in the light of what he just said and what he's going to go on to say and that kind of thing. And when Jack said that, I knew exactly what he's talking about because I knew how to do that. That was something I knew how to do. I had just never really done it with the Bible before. So this opened up a huge doorway for me because Jack started me down the road of having a better understanding of what the gospel was about in a way that I actually felt like I could take a breath and say, okay, I can relax, I'm okay. I don't know everything, but I'm okay with God. God's okay with me. Well, now let's take the next step and figure out where we're going from here. And then also, the approach to the Bible that he was taking started to renew my confidence in the Bible. As I started to look at it more and look at it in this way, things started to make more and more sense, and I was losing that sense that this thing is incoherent and it doesn't know what it's talking about. Okay. Third important step along the way for me then is because of this hunger to try to understand what the Bible is about, I took the classes that Jack and others were teaching in this program, the biblical studies program at this church. So I took Greek and I took Hebrew and I took Jack's and Turk class several times, and just about anything they would let me take, I took. And it was all because I just wanted to personally understand. I wanted to be able to read the Bible and understand my own faith better. But bit by bit, as much as I was trying to go down this road over here, I found God sort of pulling me in the direction of becoming a teacher myself, which is not what I wanted to do. That's not what I was interested in. I wanted to understand the Bible so that I could live my life and then go off and make movies, which was what I was born to do. So discovering that I was not born to do that was another one of those troubling issues, but I won't go into that. So finally, Jack ended up asking me to do a little teaching in this program that had been going on. And so I became a teacher, a very young, inexperienced teacher. And there were a couple of folks who, it was time for the people in this program to be doing a workshop in the Hebrew Old Testament. But there were a couple of students who were not taking Hebrew. And so they needed somebody to take them through a book in the New Testament for a workshop. And so I was asked to teach this exegetical workshop in the New Testament to two people. I decided, look, I have no question at all in my mind that my number one problem with the Bible is the book of James. So it's time for me to confront this head on. So I said, hey, okay, well, I'll do an exegetical workshop and let's make it in the book of James. So again, my two issues were coming together here. I was getting more confidence in the gospel, but I was still troubled by James saying we're justified by works, and I couldn't figure out how to make sense of that. And I was troubled by the fact that James and Paul seemed to disagree. Here, I mean, I was gaining more confidence in the Bible, But I still was troubled by the fact that it didn't seem like they were really together in this stuff. So, I'm quite certain that that little workshop in James probably did nothing for the two students who were taking it. I was very inexperienced as a teacher. This was almost 30 years ago. I didn't even want to be a teacher, really. So, you know, that I'm sure, I mean, I know, I just cringe thinking back on it. I'm sure I did a terrible job. I probably didn't even pay that much attention to them, actually. I was just kind of, wow, let's look at this. You know, so, but as it turned out, doing that workshop in James is probably one of the most important things that I ever did, because it was my first shot at really sitting down to, okay, let me just try to figure out what the heck is going on with this. I want to understand what James is doing. And I set out to do it with a very deliberate goal in mind. I was not going to cheat. I'm not going to go in there and try to twist James and make him agree with Paul. I want to study James straight. And if he says something, it turns out that he's right and Paul's wrong, or I've misunderstood Paul and somehow that the gospel isn't as gracious as I thought it was somehow or something, well, that's what I got to know. I have to live with this for the rest of my life. There is no point in trying to trick myself into thinking it's okay. I wanted to look at it and know what the heck is James talking about. And so that's the goal that I went into it with. And the process of studying the book of James really helped to bring closure on my two issues and opened up a new chapter in my life in dealing with the Bible. Because what I found in James made a great deal of sense to me, was very compelling, did not contradict what Paul was saying at all, but I came away with two things. Theologically, I felt like I was understanding what it was that James was talking about, and that it was a very important thing. Now, I don't want to go, I mean, there's a whole bunch we could say about James, but let me just really briefly say that when looking at Paul talking about being justified by works and the fact that we're not, the kind of works that Paul has in mind are good works, moral works, those kinds of things that I would look to and say, see God, you ought to accept me, look at how good I've been, look at what I've done. And Paul's saying, no, it doesn't work that way. It is in fact the grace of God that we're counting on. It is my believing God's promise that he will forgive me in Christ, that's what I'm called on to do. I can't earn God's approval by how good I do. But James, I came to realize, was talking about a very different issue. He was writing to what I would describe as sort of nominal Christians, assemblies of believers who in the way they looked and the way they were conducting themselves, it was hard to tell that they were in fact believers at all. And what James was saying was that faith has to be real. Faith is a genuine decision of the will to believe the promises of God, and that you cannot make that decision to believe this without having it affect the way you live. He wasn't saying that if you become a believer, you won't sin and your works will be perfect and earn your way to heaven. What he was saying is, if you believe this stuff, then you will live like a believer. A believer has a different set of beliefs, a different set of values, and those can't help but influence the way you conduct yourself. So that truth, I came to believe ultimately, is actually one of the fundamental truths that the New Testament deals with, and most of the New Testament is talking to us about that, that in the midst of my life, as I confront somebody hurts me and I have to decide whether to forgive them, or somebody is offering me some great riches if I do something evil, and I'm having to, as I confront the issues of my life, I'm having to decide, do I really believe this stuff or not? Is this really true? And I came to see that and believe that that's what James was talking about. Okay, so I actually found that to be a very helpful and important thing, and it has held up, as I say, as I have studied the Bible, I have seen that theme over and over again. And I really think what James was saying is fundamentally important. It also helped to bring some closure on the issue of whether the Bible is a coherent book that can be understood. Because number one, as I worked on understanding James, I felt like it was becoming clearer and clearer to me what he was doing. I would no longer have that sense of what in the heck is going on here, but it actually started to make sense to me. I said, yeah, I think I can see what it is that James is up to here. And I also found that there was no problem of coherence between what Paul was saying and what James was saying, that you could take the ideas they had and put them together in a very coherent and meaningful picture. Each of them is talking about a different aspect of that picture. So I came away from this study with kind of finally having settled for myself my conviction that I could count on the Bible and that it was, that I could study it with profit, that I could expect to make progress toward understanding what it was that it was saying, and that I could have confidence in what it was saying. So, at that point then, is kind of, around that time or a little bit after that is when we ended up coming to Eugene. It's like 26 years ago or something like that. And my teaching work really started in earnest. Back there, I was just, I think of myself as kind of an apprentice. I was just sort of trying it on. But when I came to Eugene, I finally started in earnest to do this thing. And those two themes have been the themes of my work. What is the nature of the gospel? What does the Christian life look like? What does it mean to be a believer? I have tried to understand that theme as best I could in the teaching of Jesus and Paul and James and Peter and John and those guys. And if you want to know how I would answer that question, I wrote a book about it. It's called Righteous Sinners. And then the other theme that has been a great part of what it is I've done over the past 25 years is this question of the nature of how we understand the Bible. How do we come to know what the Bible's saying? How can I have any confidence that I have understood what a particular author is saying? And I've done a lot of thinking about that as well. And if you want to know what I think about that, I contributed to a book that was on that topic along with David and Jack, and it's called The Language of God. So this talk is actually a commercial for two books. They're available in the office. Those are the fundamental things that brought me to the place I am now. The Gutenberg College experience, which has been going on for the last decade or long, I don't know, how long have we been doing this? Yeah, I don't know. Decade at least, haven't we? Has brought me to confront another issue that I'm still in the process of kind of working with. But remember, if you look at my story, I started out as fairly skeptical, even as a Christian, as fairly skeptical about whether we could understand the Bible or not. And my experience has led me to be less and less skeptical of our ability to do that. But the fact is, at the same time that I have been getting less and less skeptical, I have seen the culture around me, including the Christian culture, become more and more skeptical about that very thing, about whether we can know, whether can we understand the Bible, should we even be trying to understand the Bible. I see movements in Christianity these days that would say we can't really know what the biblical authors meant, or it doesn't really matter what they meant then, what matters is what it means to us now, or theology isn't really important, what matters is that we love people, and so on. So here I have become this person who believes that we can actually learn in a significant way from the Bible, just as the Bible seems to claim that we can. And I would like to inspire people with confidence that this is a profitable thing. This is a thing that we ought to take on. Just at the time when everybody around me is putting the Bible down and saying, well, we know we can't really do much with that, so let's all gather in a circle and love each other. And it's very frustrating to me because I say, no, put that, pick that Bible back up here, guys. So my years at Gutenberg have kind of been an opportunity to explore a little bit. I mean, this is not on the front burner. I have a task to do at Gutenberg. But as the students can tell you, I managed to work this issue into pretty much anything I teach. So even when we're doing Euclid, part of what we talk about is, you know, how do you know whether something's true or not? So my time at Gutenberg, I am not a philosopher. I am a reader. I like to read and understand, and I am especially interested in understanding what the Bible has to say, because I think it is the Word of God that it claims to be, and nothing I have ever read has been more important to me than what the Bible has taught me, although I've read a lot of stuff and I like to read. So I am committed to this idea that we want to get in and try to understand what this thing is about. But as I say, I'm not really a philosopher. Jack has a PhD in philosophy. Charlie has a PhD in philosophy. My son is pursuing a PhD in philosophy. I have serious doubts whether I could stick it out doing a PhD in philosophy. There would come a point at which I'd say, okay, I think that's enough of that. Let's go do something else. So I'm not an expert on these things, but I am very interested in the skepticism of my culture around me. Some of the aspects of postmodernism and the things that are happening in the church, the emergence of people who have looked at the failings in evangelicalism, which are many, and said, yeah, the problem with them is they think they know something about the Bible. And in a way, they're right. That is their problem. They think they know something about the Bible. But on the other hand, wait a minute. Like, the Bible seems to think it's profitable to read it. How did we decide that it isn't? So I can't give you a neat answer to this part, but it is true that over the past decade, I have, in the readings at Gutenberg, just trying to think about the different philosophers who have influenced, that have brought us to this place of skepticism. I'm trying to understand it better so that I can deal honestly with the objections that are being raised. I mean, there are people in the church today who would listen to what I'm saying there and say, well, you know, Ron, that's a really great story, but I was looking at Jack when I said that. I don't have delusions of Jackness. It's not. But that's a really great story, Ron, but, you know, you like to kind of keep up with the times. I mean, that would be a great story, like back in, you know, like the 18th century or something. But we've made a lot of progress these days in understanding that it doesn't work that way anymore. So I have tried to think about, what is my answer to that skepticism or to that idea that somehow what we need is the humility to recognize that we don't really know anything and that it is inappropriate to claim that we really know anything. Let me just say that where I'm sitting with all of that right now is that I do acknowledge that there can be an evil kind of orthodoxy, a commitment to, yes, I know the truth, I've got the right answers, you have to have the right answers or you're not a good guy, and I'm a good guy because I have the right answers. That attitude is very possible and it's very ugly, and I agree that we ought to run away from it. But I think there also can be an evil kind of false humility, a claim that none of us can really know anything, and I'm too humble to claim that I really know anything about anything. It all comes back to this question of the relationship between my will and my knowledge, it seems to me. I have a moral obligation to embrace the truth. I mean, Romans 1 says, the wrath of God is upon us because the truth of God we have put aside. You can't safely put aside the truth. So since I have that moral obligation, that means I need to be humble, willing to hear arguments that might show me to be wrong. But it also means that I need to be submissive. That is, there is a truth to be known, and I am called upon to submit to that truth and acknowledge that it's true. It's abundantly clear that every single biblical author believed that God was revealing truth in the Bible and that the truth could be known. I have never found an exception. They all think, I'm saying something that is from God, it's true, and you can know what I'm talking about. So it seems to me that we are all called upon to humbly submit ourselves to that truth. We're all in a state of progress, and we don't understand much, but I think the most important things can be understood, and we can have confidence that we understand them if we look carefully. So right now, then, I am trying to argue for and hold out for the stance that I think we need to take is this kind of a humble passion for the truth. I need to be passionate to understand as much as I can about what is true and humble about my abilities to do so. Okay, so I don't know. That last part maybe wandered off a little bit there, but that's my story. Remember, I was asked to tell the story, so that's why I did it. The next time I tell you this story, that'll be because I want to talk about myself. But this time it was because I was asked. So, any questions? Okay, here's this here.
Hello. I've enjoyed hearing you speak so far.
That's about to end.
But I've found it interesting that you haven't spoken at all about Christ, and I'm interested to know what your initial ideas of Jesus Christ was, and how they are now, and how they've changed.
Right. It's not because, I mean, it's true I didn't do that. I could have, there's a whole sub part of this story that is about that. Because when I first became a Christian, what I was really doing was becoming a theist. I mean, I was saying, okay, I'm admitting that God is there. And I was quite willing to acknowledge that, okay, the Bible, this is God writing this stuff, and it talks about Jesus, and he's the Messiah, or he's the Christ, and okay, fine. What's a Christ? I don't know. And when I looked at Jesus, I mean, I was actually kind of troubled and embarrassed for a number of years because he was like the weirdest guy that I had ever seen. And I thought, this is my Lord and Savior and all of that stuff, and let's look at Paul. I mean, Paul's rational. Paul's making arguments, and he makes sense. And so I didn't know what to do with Jesus for a while. I mean, I understood that the cross was central to this grace of God that I so desperately needed. So I understood. You understand, I wasn't dismissing Jesus. It was like this very weird guy that I could not understand at all, who then sacrificed his life to save me. So, I mean, this is my hero, right? I mean, this is great. I love this. But I have no idea what he's talking about. And I don't really understand what any of this stuff is about. So, one of the things that was helpful to me also about Jack's interp class was not only the stuff that he was teaching from Romans at the time and the various things about interpretation, but Jack had a section in that interpretation class on the parables of Jesus. And it was in that class that I started to, I agreed with the picture that Jack was painting about what Jesus was doing in the parables. As I looked at them, I said, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. And when I started to see what was going on there, they changed. It used to be, you know, people would say, look at what a great teacher Jesus was. He has these stories where he uses examples from nature and all of this kind of stuff. And my response was, if he's such a great teacher, how come I don't have any idea what he's talking about? Shouldn't a great teacher, like, you know, teach, you know, so that you actually understand something. But I had this huge shift where I came to see that I felt like I understood the picture of things that Jesus was painting, or starting to see it in the parables at first. And then that drew me into the expositional teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, and those kinds of things. And now I would say that I have recovered the appropriate, that is, I would argue as I look at the New Testament, that Jesus is central. I mean, that sounds easy. I mean, of course he's central. We're Christians, right? But what I mean is, as I look at his teaching, that's the fundamental thing. That's what, you want to understand what the Christian life is about? Jesus has described that. You want to understand what salvation is about? Jesus has described that. If you want to understand who God is and what we are called to, Jesus has laid the foundation for all of that stuff. And Paul and the other guys really are his appointed messengers to go out and clarify the details at the afterwards. So to me now, the three statements about Jesus, that he's prophet, priest, and king. I actually think oftentimes, you know, sayings like that end up thinking, well, that doesn't really capture it. But I actually think that does capture it. And to me, Jesus is the prophet in that his explanation and revelation of the teaching about God is the pinnacle of God's revelation. What he revealed in his teaching is, that's where it's at, and all the rest of it kind of falls in place around and under that. And priest is the part where he is that one who has made the offering of himself to God so that I could be reconciled with God. So the very fact that I can stand before God is due to the fact that it was God's decision to have Jesus make this offering on our behalf. So Jesus is the reason. He's the one that has made it possible for me to be where I am. And then the king part is now, but ultimately when we talk about the kingdom of God, we're talking about Jesus, the Christ, the anointed king, subduing all of creation and ultimately bringing it under his rule so that everything, all of life and reality, has been redeemed and restored and is in obedience to God and is what it ought to be. So, he's the great teacher, he made my salvation possible, and he is the one who is going to subdue all of creation and make everything worth living. So that's how I see Jesus now. But yeah, at the start, I couldn't have said any of that stuff. And I was embarrassed by the fact that I didn't even know what to do with him.
I hope this is not off subject, but...
Is it about me?
No. So, Jack may want to input on this too, but...
That was a joke.
I'm starting to get the understanding that you're saying that the parables are kind of like for the immediate students, and they're supposed to disseminate and clarify this out to the general populace. In that, I'm not saying that I agree with that statement, but I'm kind of getting that from you.
No, I didn't mean to say that. I think the parables are meant for Jesus' disciples, including us. I mean, they are very much a teaching tool, but they're like kind of, you know, they're not a pill that you pop. It's more like kind of an all-day sucker. You know, you just have to kind of keep working on.
I like the analogy.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Well,
I'm serious, and what I'm saying is that they're intended to not immediately, you're not supposed to immediately go, oh yeah, that's obvious. You're supposed to have to kind of think about, what's going on in this story and how does that relate to the kingdom of God and that kind of stuff. But no, I think they're very much intended for us.
Okay, that brings me to the second point. Do you think there was something in them that was culturally relevant to the society that they were in to help them understand? So that brings me to the point that some of what we should do, should be trying to do, is to, quote, come up with our own parables. Not saying, you know, that I'm using parables for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. You know, not saying that we can do exactly what Jesus did. But mm-hmm. this type of thing that we, well, Francis Schaeffer, in essence, did a little bit of that. Because mm-hmm. it was very striking to me, although, gosh, I think I should have gotten it. But, I mean, Jesus is just like someone from another planet. Mm-hmm. To the most of the people around here. And many of the things we say, just like, okay, that's nice, but...
Right.
You know?
Right. I like that. I don't think I'm necessarily the person to do it. It's not really... I'm better at just... I mean, if I have any skill, it's like explaining what I think. Let me tell you straight out. Here's what I think is going on. But I have been struck. Another thing that Jack has introduced me to, as he has many people, is the writing of Kierkegaard. And I'm convinced by Jack that off topic, Kierkegaard is great because of the emphasis on that fundamental truth that I was talking about, that idea that I have to decide personally whether I am going to embrace this thing. It's interesting to me that what I was using to describe to myself, I'd come up to the edge and then I'd back off. I didn't want to jump. That's exactly the way Kierkegaard describes that decision that has to be made. Are you going to make the jump or not? And so I like that. But there's another aspect of what Kierkegaard says that has been very challenging to me. Because Kierkegaard, his model, I think, for how we ought to communicate is the parables of Jesus and Socrates. I mean, and if you think, and both of them have that quality of not straightforwardly saying what they think, but provoking people, saying things that get people misunderstanding and making people own it for themselves. That's what he said. It forces you. He says... And this, I mean, this is just a slap in the face to me and what I do. So I think about it a lot, and I take it seriously. But Kierkegaard said that, you know, to just explain to somebody, you know, the things of the faith and that kind of stuff is like giving someone the answers to the test. That what they need to do is to have to work through it for themselves so that they can own it and decide whether they're going to work with it. So Kierkegaard deliberately wrote in a manner that was difficult to understand, basically saying, so if you're interested, try to keep up, you know. I'm too worried about what people think of me, I think, you know. I'm afraid I'll say, hey, if anybody, you know, try to keep up, and I'll turn around and look and everybody's gone. I'm not sure that I want that. I actually think that there really is something to that. A kind of communication like what Jesus did that is provocative. It gets people engaged and thinking about it, and then when they figure out what it's really dealing with, then they, not that you've tricked them into belief or anything like that. There is nothing that you can do to convince another person to make that choice to believe. But it, at least it gives them an opportunity to engage in it in a way that might be educational for them. So yeah, I like that.
Well, I think you've touched on it with a couple of things, but like, for instance, one thing, I mean, when Jesus says you are the salt of the earth, I mean, that means absolutely nothing.
Right. Well, and so there's two aspects to that then. One of them is, I think you're right, we could talk to each other in ways that would use analogies and ideas that mean more to us than where we are right now. But the other part of it is, if I personally am interested in being a disciple of Jesus, then I want to understand what he was talking about, which means I have to try to learn to put myself back where they were and figure out what would salt have meant in that situation so that I know what he's talking about.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're ministering to, you know, the modern day equivalent of a pagan, then they're not going to be really interested in that.
Right.
And that's right. What I was
right.
Addressing.
No, exactly. That's why I say there's two, both of those things are valid, I think. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that's been a realization to me is like, most people aren't interested in really studying this stuff and really getting to know it. And it's, the intellectual challenge is not something they want to do.
And they probably don't think it's going to pay off much in the end, even if they do like intellectual challenges.
As you describe yourself, you've spoken really directly and plainly about how much you stake yourself on the Bible as being the Word of God. So can you, I'd like to just hear how you articulate why you have confidence that that is so.
Okay. I can't answer that question, but I have to think about it here for a second. Partly I want to say, I was thinking about trying to talk about all this stuff too, but there was obviously I didn't have time to do that. Some people, when they approach the question of, you know, well, so why should I believe in the Bible? We think about it as if it's kind of like, you know, an axiom in geometry or a proposition that I'm putting together. I'm going to come up with a logical proof. I'm going to start here, and then I'm going to work my way toward a proof that the Bible is the Word of God. I think that's not the way that we come to understand most things, and that only gets us partway there if we try to take that approach. What I would say is that I came to believe that the picture of life with God made more sense than the picture of life without him. And then the question is, what place does the Bible have in that? And one of the parts of my journey that I didn't describe was in that spot where I was wrestling with the place that the Bible had. I now believe in the what people call the inerrancy of the Bible. I think that everything that the Bible means to say is true. I have to be careful that I've understood what it means to say, but I'm not going to find the Bible saying that it's white and it turns out that it's black, I would say. But I didn't have that belief when I started into this stuff. And Jack probably remembers, although it was a long time ago, you may not remember, but when I first was taking that interp class, I would sit in the back and argue with him about the inerrancy of the Bible, which he was arguing for and I was convinced was not true. So just another one of the arguments that I've lost to Jack over the years. And I do like to mention I haven't lost all of them, but but I have lost many of them. So the so with that general idea that the picture of life with God makes more sense than the picture without him. And then I look at the general teaching of the Bible concerning, especially when it comes to human nature, the problem of sin and that sort of stuff. I looked at that, and that's one thing that I never for a minute had any problem with. I looked at that description and I said, that is just flat out true. This is the way I am. This is the way everybody I know is. So that gave me confidence that in general, I mean, there's something to this. This is describing this right. So then the question becomes, what does the Bible claim for itself? I mean, I don't start out assuming that the Bible is inerrant or everything that it says is right, But I see that it is a record of people who have encountered this God, and the picture that is emerging from it is making sense to me. So what does this Bible have to say for itself? And then, this is where, in those arguments that I was having with Jack back then, he would point to, and there's some books that were very significant to me at the time that I read that pointed to the high level of confidence that Jesus had in the Bible. And so it's kind of like, well, I have to confront this question of whether, basically, I am the sinner that the Bible says I am, and I need the salvation that this Jesus has offered. And if I get that far, then the question becomes, well, what does he have to say for himself? And what he claims is that he speaks with this authority from God, that he is sending out representatives like Peter and Paul and people like that who have been trained to speak for him authoritatively, that the prophets had spoken from God and that they spoke accurately and they spoke about him. And so he's sort of tying this whole package together, saying this thing is telling you what God's about. And so then you face that question. Well, if I believe that he is, in general, the Christ that he says he is, then I guess I ought to take seriously how confident he is in this. So, and then the last step is experientially, bit by bit. I mean, there are lots of questions that I have about the Bible. I can't tell you that I have answered every question. You could point to a problem. I know that I could point to problems. In fact, I've said this before. I think that the guys who write these atheist websites where they say, here's the problem with Christianity, they're amateurs. Their problems with Christianity are so easy to answer. I could write an atheist website that would really get in there and do some damage, because, I mean, let's get in and get the hard questions here. But I mean, so there are some hard questions, and I don't have the answer to all of those questions. But I have had the experience over and over again of kind of hammering on some of the problems that, like the James problem, but others, you know, over the years, where as I look at it and start to look in context and, oh, okay, let's see what's going on, that what seems to be a problem starts to go away. So I have that experience of, you know, tasting it, and the more I taste it, the better it tastes. So I have an intellectual foundation that says I ought to put confidence in it, and experientially I find that my confidence has not been misplaced. So that's how I would describe it. Emily, and then Reed.
I just wondered how you decided what your calling was, or that you were supposed to go into teaching instead
right.
of going into make movies or whatever.
Right, right. It was real easy. I failed at being a movie maker, and I succeeded at being a teacher. I mean, that was. I mean, let me be serious for a moment. One of the things that I came to believe was a central theme in the Bible, as I was trying to understand what the Bible was teaching, was the idea of the testing of our faith, the idea that God deliberately takes us through situations in life that force us to confront the question, what is valuable to me? What do I really believe? Okay, and it can be a variety of things, but one of the things that he can use in this way is to take something valuable that I really value away from me, or not give me the thing that I want. And I had a passion. I wanted to be not a Hollywood filmmaker, but I wanted to just have my own little independent film company and make documentaries and stuff like that. You know, that's what I wanted to do in life. If I couldn't do that, I would have settled for playing the guitar for a living. Either one of those would have been all right, but movies were more important. And I tried, and I discovered that I am not temperamentally suited to that job, and I'm actually a significant moral failure in many ways, such that I was my own worst enemy, and I ended up sabotaging my own attempts to try to do this. And I faced, along with all that other turmoil that I'm describing, I did come very close to telling God to get lost. It's like, don't you, what's all this nonsense about you love me? I mean, don't you know this is like the most important thing in the world to me, and you could make it happen like that, and you won't. And I was totally, I mean, I just can't tell you how upset and I was over that and how much I thought about what did this mean. And in the end, it was one of the most valuable experiences personally in my personal struggles with God, not intellectual struggles, but volitional struggles, my struggle of my will and heart, was to realize, you know, God didn't promise me that I was going to get the job I want in life. What he promised me was that he was going to forgive me and he was going to rescue me from my sin and bring me into his kingdom of righteousness and fulfillment forever. So is that enough for me? I mean, it sounds silly to say that, but that was the question. Is that enough? I mean, can I convince myself that that's really where it's at and not necessarily this other stuff? And that took me some years to sort through. But in the end, I consciously sort of bowed the knee before God and said, no, you know what you're doing. And if not me not having this is important in me, ultimately arriving at what you have promised, then I'll take it. So that was significant to me. And meanwhile, while all of that stuff was going on, I just stumbled into this teaching stuff. I mean, I didn't want to do it, but people kept coming to me. I mean, nobody was coming to me wanting me to make a movie, and the reason was because I don't think I would have been very good at it. But people kept coming to me. I mean, I would be in class at the place taking classes, and people would want to come to me and have me explain how the stuff was working. And it's not what I wanted to do, but I just kind of kept noticing that explaining stuff to people seems to kind of be the thing that I do, which is not what I wanted to do, but that's what I do, it seems to be. And then finally, Jack said, well, so you want to be a teacher? And my initial reaction was sort of hesitant. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to or not. I don't know that I'm any sort of a model. I don't think God does it all kinds of different ways. But for me, I didn't decide at all on my career or my path or calling. I was called into it backwards while I was trying to do something else. You know, I'm doing this. Oh, where am I? Literally, I mean, isn't that, don't you think that's fair? I mean, that's pretty much how it happened, right? So, sure. Read.
Not so much on the intellectual level, in our spiritual level. You know the verses or the areas in the scripture where it talks about where Paul is saying, if indeed you have been taught by Christ, or if you are being taught in him and or by him, even though he resurrected and ascended to heaven already, and he continually teaches like that Jesus does teach every individual that is his. And it's obvious it's not like David here or Caleb or Sam, that same kind of teaching. But in your own experience, have you had those moments where you couldn't say Jesus was like obviously right there with you in the physical sense, but it felt as if he was teaching you in a very, very, maybe what you said already would count to an extent, but where it seems he took your eyes and or your head, as it were, and just kind of made you see something you didn't want to see, as it were, and just followed that?
Okay. I'd actually like to talk to you about those passages that you were talking about. I'm not sure which ones you mean exactly, and it might be instructive to look at them and see what was being talked about there. I would say that mostly, I would say absolutely that I have been taught, I mean, I don't know how to sort out, I mean, taught by Jesus or taught by the Father or taught by the Spirit. I mean, I've been taught by God But mostly I would describe that in terms that the Bible describes it. It's that it's going through the fire and discovering afterwards that I have learned this thing that, that God has taught me. Occasionally, I did have this experience once that it was quite striking, but I don't put a lot of stock in it, really. But there was a parable that I was studying that I had always wondered. I never really felt like I knew what was going on in it. And I was looking at it, and all of a sudden, it doesn't usually happen this way, but it just sort of full-formed into my head just the answer. I mean, what seemed to me to be, oh, yeah, that's what's going on here. And it was so striking that I just had no, and all of a sudden, just, that I actually kind of stood up and I kind of backed up against the wall like, what was that? You know, I was like, that was weird. So, but that might not have been anything like that at all. I don't know whether it was or not. But that's not, my experience is that, see, I don't think that they're fundamentally, the work of the Spirit is not to put ideas in my head that I don't know what the source of them is. The work of the Spirit is to work on my will so that I am willing to understand and pursue the truth that is in front of me. So I don't see a conflict between reasoning my way to an understanding of a text and being taught by God in the same process. So I'm not, in theory, against that sort of thing. It's up to God to do whatever he wants to do, and God can quite easily come along and do things with me very differently than he's done before. But usually it's just more a process of studying and thinking about it and looking up a Greek word and thinking about things and then kind of slowly going, oh, that might make sense, and just working your way like that.
Well, what do you do in the situation where, let's say, you know, someone who's been a believer longer than you, and you can tell by their life they truly do believe it, mm-hmm. The life shows it plainly, and there are some things that the Bible says about our principles, and it's not even to do with the Bible, but they honestly know God wants them to do this thing at this certain moment, mm-hmm. And they do it, and it works exactly as if.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only had very small moments where it's been like that, but I know other mm-hmm. people in that situation where if they didn't do what they felt that they should do, it wouldn't be good, or you'd feel not guilt. Like, I'm being very inarticulate right now.
Well, let me articulate something and see if this speaks to what you're saying. In theory, like I say, I'm open to God doing whatever, and I'm not, I could easily believe that something like that could happen. I think it is a mistake to emphasize. I have known Christians over the years who have faulted me and us around here because what we ought to emphasize instead of studying the Bible is listening to the voice of the Spirit inside. That's, you obey by listening to what the voice of the Spirit tells you and then going out and doing what the voice tells you to do. And that if you're not doing that, you're not being obedient to God. And I think that's not wise. That's not a good way to go. But could God intervene in ways to say something or communicate something at certain points? I have had experiences that seem like that. I just think we need to be humble about them, not claim more than we know is what's going on. But yeah.
That's what I meant along with the question was, if what they felt they should do, it has nothing wrong with the Scripture, it's not wrong. Mm-hmm. He's not saying,
right.
Thus saith the Lord like a prophet,
right.
Or something
right.
new.
Right.
But they just honestly feel like they should do something.
Yeah. Well, I'm not in a position to tell them that they're wrong. I mean, so it would depend on our relationship and how I saw that playing itself out over time. I mean, the place where I get nervous is when people seem to be downplaying what the Bible would tell us about what's important and elevating something else into importance because they're saying that God told them so. And that can happen. It can easily happen. And that's something to warn people about. But I'm not saying, I'm in no position to say it can't happen.
And I'm not saying it's a voice. It's more of a compulsion. It feels like your will is just kind of been shut down type of thing.
Right, right. Well,
that's what I mean.
You know, when Robbie and I moved here, we had no job. There was no guarantee. We came to work with Jack, but we hadn't even been accepted by the board of McKenzie Study Center to work here when we moved here. And we had little money. We came, I think, I had the feeling that this is what God wanted me to do. I would have said, I think this is what God wants me to do. I couldn't prove it from the Bible or anything. But I did have the attitude at the same time, well, I could be wrong about that. I can't go back to God afterwards and say, you said, I mean, you know, this. I think this is what I'm supposed to do, but I could be wrong. But so I think that's part of being a Christian. I just think that fundamentally what we are called to do is understand God's promises and God's values and to live in the light of those things, and that most of the decisions we make are just based on knowing those things and having the right priorities and stuff. Okay, well, we're kind of out of time. So, you know, you guys, it's just a lot of fun to talk about yourself for an hour and a half. So I hope you'll forgive me for that, for actually enjoying myself doing that. But I promise next time I'll talk about somebody else.